I heard an interview this past week with an expert talking about scarcity. And before you get nervous, I'm not going to talk about money, ours or anybody else's, this morning. The person, in any event, was not talking about the shortage of money when they were talking about scarcity. They were talking about a sensation. They were talking about the sensation of shortage. Whether that experience comes to us as somebody that feels like they don't have enough time or sleep, as Jane talked about this morning, or energy or friends or money or whatever. Whatever it is that drives that sensation. And the point that this particular person was making in the interview was that the experience of not enough, the experience of scarcity, takes up an enormous amount of brain space. And it reduces our functional capacity in really significant ways. And so really, it's really kind of, as an abstract, it's intriguing. As an experience, it's disconcerting, at the least. But this particular person illustrated their point by citing a study that they had done together with a research group, academic research group, where the test that they gave people, the device that they used, was that the subjects in the study had to carry around in their head, not written down anywhere, just in their memory, a 10-digit phone number for the day. A new one, one they didn't know, that they were given. And all they had to do was kind of go through their day consciously remembering this phone number. And then during the course of the events of the day, they were given a battery of tests, which they had been given previously under different circumstances without this task. Given a battery of tests, including some of the standard tests that are used when IQ is measured. And what they found, what the researchers found, was that just the act of having to carry around in your head this phone number could reduce your measurable IQ by a degree roughly equal to the difference in degree between normal IQ and genius on the positive side, or between normal EQ and seriously impaired functioning on the other side of the equation, just by having to remember a phone number. I heard that documentary and I thought, Corrine needs to be in this car with me right now. So she could, anyways, you know, I always want to be better understood and have an excuse for all the things that go in one ear and out the other. No, honey, it's because my mind is full of, anyway. Well, if we were kind of going to stay in this tradition of like pop psych church, what I should say now is that God made us this way, so we should all start making exhaustive lists so we can get the things out of our heads and onto paper, and then we can think about God more, and then we could all go home or have some coffee and some of that great baking. And one of the reasons I kind of want to make fun of that a little bit is because part of the ethos of this community seems to be that we insist on thinking about things. And some of them are new, and some of them are hard. And that can be good, but it can also take up a lot of brain space. So it's not an unambiguously good thing, like many good things. But thinking about things is hard work. And I had this experience over this past week of feeling like a lot of my brain space was used up kind of in advance of the week. And I realized when I was thinking about it later in the week that a big part of what I was carrying around in my head that was taking up all of that mental space was just thinking about the details and the what-ifs and the how-will-we's of this move to a new location for us, which is proceeding. That's exciting, positive stuff that I was thinking about. There was very little, I realized on reflection, that I was wrestling with that felt negative. But it was still taking up a lot of space. And maybe, it occurred to me late in the week, too late in the week, perhaps, maybe it was taking up enough space to impair my cognitive functioning in a way that meant that there were some occasions where I probably shouldn't have been driving, never mind driving and checking my voicemail on my headset, while listening to new music and thinking about this gathering and talking to my kids in the back seat. And so I had to sort of stop and think about that for a little bit without all of that, you know, distraction. And when I did that, I realized that there was one bit of what I'd been thinking about, what I'd been carrying around front of mind, that kept coming back to me. That kind of kept, this little burr in my mental socks. And I realized that that's a thing that as the pastor in this community, I need to get out there. I need to process and talk about and try to articulate for us as a community and have us be thinking about as a community. And just so you know, that's not the kind of experience that dials down my excitement about what we're doing at all. This is a very positive thing. In fact, it's pretty much the opposite. But it could fall under, what I'm going to talk about, could fall under the things we need to be mindful of category as we take on the process of an actual physical change of place. We've been dabbling around in the earliest chapters of the biblical story for the last few weeks. They're interesting stories. Not least of all, because they're so ancient that we really don't know very much about them. We don't know very much about their milieu. And so one of the positive things about that is that, like reading a good poem or listening to a good song, there's lots of room in those stories for us to see and hear our own stories. There's lots of room in those stories for us to recognize our own challenges and sorrows and joys and intrigues and all those things that comprise our sensation of life, our felt, lived experience of every day. And one of the ways to understand that bunch of stories that comprises most of the book of Genesis is as the birth of a different kind of tribe. And it's inside that bigger story of a birth of a different kind of tribe that I bumped into a particular story that felt like it had lots of resonance with this move that we're planning as a community. As far as we can tell, the cultural context for the birth of this curious thing that we now maybe think of as the people of God, the Hebrew story from which the Christian story derives, that story could be understood as one in which there's a progression, a sort of a moving forward. And I think there's already, if we understand that story generally like that, there's already some resonance with our experience as a community. We're not moving because we can't stay. We're moving because we want to move forward. We want to change in ways that our best understanding suggests should or could be better. Or to put it another way, we're moving because we want to positively evolve as a community. And so if we try to put ourselves into the shoes of a guy like Abraham for a moment, because that's sort of the bit of the story that I want to think about, the beginning of this tribe. Abraham lives in a tribal culture, and he is surrounded by tribes of many different sorts. One of the things those tribes would have had in common is that they would have all understood themselves to have an identifiable originator or father or patriarch, somebody who's kind of the hub of the wheel of the tribe, if you want. Some of those tribes would have been peripatetic. They would have wandered around. Some of them would have been more settled. And in terms of the broader strain of theme of history, we would understand the story of Abraham and the beginning of this tribe to take place at a point in the larger history of humanity that's around where the idea of agriculture emerges. So to put it into a bigger context. And the idea of agriculture, of course, changes the shape of human culture enormously when it occurs. And we've talked here before about the current research from Ubeki Teple from whether the question is whether did agriculture come first and give birth to religion, or did religion come first and give birth to agriculture? Anyway, we won't get into that this morning, as intriguing as it is. But we're right at that point in the bigger themes of what's going on with humanity. And so this is a world of change where this story happens. And there's lots of different kind of tribes in this changing world. There would be some tribes that we've said wandered, some that were becoming more settled. There would have been some that had lots of possessions and were wealthy. There would have been some that were poor. There would have been some that been more bellicose, more inclined to war, warlike, war-making. Some of those warlike tribes would have kept armies, and they would have gone to war often, and that would have been their way of moving forward. There would have been other tribes that really tried hard to keep to themselves, and some of those tribes would have formed alliances with others so that the others who kept armies could defend themselves, and there would have been still more tribes that would have been the ones that everyone seemed to want an alliance with. And in the end, in terms of the affective or felt experience of the persons, each person's identity would have been connected to the tribe that they were a part of and to the dominant characteristics of that tribe. This is important because We live in a world where the rights of the individual and the experience of the individual have become paramount. Fascinating Ghanaian, I believe, philosopher coming through town in the next week, who has a very intriguing take on the downside of when we think about human fundamentals as, and we think of them all as rights and the cost of rights, as opposed to good things that we all need, like access to water. Is that really a right, or is that something other than a right? But we live in this culture where this idea of the individual rights is kind of run amok, such that, that observant philosophers would see that, that there's a problematic part to it. But one of the things that that makes it difficult for us to process is just how deeply rooted in this tribal culture the person's identity would have been linked to the predominant characteristics of the tribe. How do you even deal with this? This is an aside, but how do you even deal with this truth in the context of a culture that overemphasizes, if you will, the rights of the individual? What kind of a personal identity is attached to a tribe whose dominant identity is we're not a tribe, to put it in, right? We're all individuals. Oh, yeah, I really identify with the tribe that's all individuals. That's my tribe. See the problem here? All right. Anyway, wouldn't have been the case in Abraham's setting. So of an important contrast there. Despite, I would contend at least, despite our vigorous emphasis on the rights of the individual in our culture, we are still inclined, whether we resist it personally or not, we are inclined to identify others by the characteristics of the tribe with which they're identified. We still do this. And if you've ever wondered about that, if you want to question that, let me offer this illustration. I don't know if any of you have ever been part of a gathering of people from a mix of backgrounds, perhaps a mix of religious or spiritual backgrounds, where you've been wondering if you should, in an appropriate way, or at all, self-identify as a Christian. Ever had that experience? Do I really want to be known by this particular label? Why would we wonder if we would want to be known by that label? Well, in the context of what I'm trying to say here this morning, one of the ways we could make the argument is that we don't want to hang out that label because of what is understood to be the dominant characteristics and behavior of the tribe called Christian. We don't want to be identified with it. Or we want to do it in a way that says, yes, I have that label, you could use that label for me, but I'm not really part of the tribe that behaves like that. I'm not that kind of person from that tribe. I'm sort of a fringe person on the tribe, or a rebel within the tribe, or an anti-tribe tribal person. Or I'm a Christian, but I'm not that, right? Okay, so some of you have had that experience. And those of us who haven't, without trying too hard, could probably think of any number of people who stepped away from the thing we could call Christianity in our current cultural context for this reason. I'm not anti-God, I'm not anti-spiritual, I'm not even anti-Jesus, I'm not anti this story of God come as in human form. I think those things are all lovely and appealing, and I may even say that I believe them and work my life around them, but I so do not wish to be identified with the behavior of this tribe. So we have this dilemma, right? And for a lot of people, because of the way we've been taught and the way our belief has been shaped, my favorite word for it is binary, as you know, this either-or-ness. A lot of people that would say, I'm not a Christian anymore. But when you sit down and talk with them, you realize that at the core, this thing that comprises this story is actually very much the story that they work their life around. But they believe it's impossible to name that story as and those people as their tribe because of the dominant characteristics or perceived dominant characteristics of the tribe and still live with any kind of joy or freedom or peace or engagement in this thing. So it's complicated. It's easy to imagine, when you think about that stuff, it's easy to imagine how one tribe could sort of take over as a stereotype, right? Sort of like in Abraham's context, you kind of imagine somebody kind of going, oh yeah, all those tribes from the south, they're a bloodthirsty bunch, they just want to make war on the north and they don't take any prisoners, and that's what it means to be from the south, right? That's all those tribes are like that. We derive a lot of our humor, by the way, from this same way of thinking, right? From stereotyping. don't know if you've ever had a chance to travel to other countries or cultures. Probably most of us have. Many of us certainly have. I know that. If you ever have, you've encountered this broad kind of stereotype. And maybe you have encountered it by being in a culture where when you speak English, you're immediately identified as being from the West because it's not the dominant language of the culture. And you start speaking English, and the first experience you have is somebody says to you with some accent or other, American, right? Because that's who speaks English. And you say, no! God, no! I'm Canadian! Right? And they're like, oh, that's good. And you know, you have this lovely experience of being a Canadian. And so anyway, that could sound like an anti-American statement, and it's not. It's more that I've traveled and had this experience, and it's been so lovely to be perceived in some of these countries as being from the tribe of Canada. Right? Well, that's that same kind of thing at work. So this is this tribal milieu that is Abram's world. And so in this milieu, it would have made perfect sense to him to have God come to him and say, Abraham, I am going to make you the father. I'm going to make you the originator of a great tribe, of a great people. You're going to be the hub of the wheel. So far, so good. But then, God, who often seems to be in the business of not leaving things where they are at, but moving them ahead to a better place, tells Abram that this is going to be a different kind of tribe. And instead of this being a great self-interested tribe whose activities are focused on benefiting themselves, this is going to be, God says, a tribe that will have a greater purpose than their own wealth, their own preservation, their own well-being. One of the things we have to try to remember when we read a story like that and try to imagine God trying to communicate this to the originator of a different sort of tribe is that these are experiences that are dominated by the base of the pyramid in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that pyramid, right? This is a world in which so much of life is comprised of just having food and shelter and survival. And so God comes to Abram and says, you're going to be the originator of a tribe that's going to behave different than that. You're going to be the originator of a tribe that gives away its best stuff. When you're struggling to survive, and your whole milieu is dominated by that, how could that possibly sound like a good kind of tribe to be? Right? But that's what God says to him. He says, this tribe that you are going to be the originator of, this tribe is going to exist to bless and benefit all the other tribes. You mean all those from the south? Like those warriors? Those, we're going to bless those guys? You mean we're going to bless the people who seem to only want our destruction? You mean those guys? Those tribes? You mean the tribes who have the good land that we need or we're going to starve? You mean those tribes? Yeah, all the other tribes. And so the thing that starts out looking and sounding familiar, this idea of originating a new tribe, then moves on to what's next. It evolves to a new state of being, a new way of looking at the world, and a new way of behaving in it. And it includes the familiar. You're going to be a tribe. And then it doesn't stay there. It transcends that into, we're a tribe that exists to bless all the other tribes. A different way of thinking about the whole world and everything in it. Try to imagine carrying that message, living that mission in this tribal world. How do you even do that? How do you go for coffee with those guys from the south? Like you just hang out this big white flag and hope that you get past what would otherwise be a deadly ambush so you can get close enough to this other tribe so you can say, I'm not here to try to find an unknown advantage so I can take you over. I'm just here to see what you need, if you need anything we have so we can give it to you. Thank you for not shooting us on the way in. This is going to be good for everybody. Like, how do you even get close enough, right? Because this is the way, that is so contrary to the way that we think and live as humans, that it's hard to imagine how you would even start to do that. And in fact, the rest of the Bible basically tells the story of how Abraham's tribe, who become the tribe that we know as the Jews, don't find that especially easy to do. They struggle to live up to their destiny. They struggle to live up to this calling, to being this unique kind of tribe that they're supposed to be. And maybe that's partly why their name, Israel, even means the one who struggles with God. And over time in this story, in this bigger biblical story, people have to keep showing up to remind this tribe that they are to exist in the world for the blessing of all the other tribes. And so the prophets are people like that, right? Isaiah is a person like that. He shows up in this story and he says things to the people of this story, to this tribe. He says, you guys, you exist to be a light. You exist to be a light to the Gentiles. Gentiles, of course, as we've talked about here many times, simply being a word that means everybody else. And then Jesus shows up in the story, and he's still talking to the same tribe, and what he says is things like, don't hide your light, let it shine. And sometimes the people in the story do, and sometimes the people in the story don't. Maybe they're like us. Or maybe we're like them. Maybe their first tendency is not to think about others, but to think about themselves. To think like this goodness of a good God, that's for us as a tribe, right? God's good to us. That's good. We like that. And if anybody else wants it, and we can imagine how they would because it's good, then they know where to find it. Right here, with us, as a tribe. And so if they want this goodness, or whatever they perceive as good in this, they can come to us and they can get it. And we'll share it. And if we want to imagine what this looks like in the 21st century, we don't really have to look any further than any encounter we've ever had with an organization or institution that doesn't seem to have any higher mission than its own self-preservation in mind. I don't know if you've ever had an experience of working in that kind of a context, but it just guts you. It seems like if we're going to try to set this into a larger story, there is this bigger narrative going on that is about God keeping on pulling humanity toward what is better, toward a greater protection of human dignity, to a more thorough integration of body and mind, a more equitable treatment of humans, the kind of thing that rises above gender or orientation or socioeconomic status, a way that keeps pulling humanity towards more compassion rather than less, toward more intellectual honesty rather than less, toward better care for the place we call home. That kind of a tug, that kind of a pull toward what is better. And it seems like, if we're going to have a little spasm of intellectual honesty here, it seems like the tribe called the church can either get with the program or watch God find ways to pull the culture, the other tribes, if you wish, forward, with or without those who claim to know the one that's doing the pulling. We can participate or not. And maybe, while we're trying to be honest about this, maybe we could all agree that whatever it is that God gives to this unique tribe as a mission at the beginning of the story is a place that we haven't reached yet. So we're still on the way somewhere. And we can tell that we haven't reached it yet whenever we find ourselves stuck in behaving like we're a tribe that is somehow above all the other tribes. Now, I don't know about you, but my experience is that I and groups that I've been a part of are most prone to this way of thinking and behaving like we were above the others. We're most prone to that when we get self-occupied. It's rarely easier, I also find, to be self-occupied than when I'm working on a project that I am personally deeply invested in or have some sense of the downside of the risk. You ever notice how if you're driving somewhere and you're in a hurry, all the other drivers are idiots?
Like they don't have the core competencies to be on the road at all?
Okay, yeah. Yeah. They are slow-moving, inconsiderate idiots, and they should stay home or get some remedial training on reading my mind. That's us. Okay? It's this deeply ingrained. We don't have to go looking for that felt experience when we're trying to go somewhere in a hurry. We just have it. We brought it into the car with us. And if you're a parent, you bring it into the house. And if you're in the workplace, you bring it into the workplace. And if you're a follower of Jesus, you bring it into the gatherings of the followers of Jesus. And there's no place that we don't bring this shit. Right? Because it's in us. Well, there are lots of ways that we could take those kind of observations and thoughts and plug them in. But what I want to do is plug them in a little bit to our thinking and acting out what it looks like to move physically to a different place, to a new place. The core rationale that we've talked about in these gatherings for this move has been presented not exclusively but primarily as a way to offer, among other things, a better quality of hospitality to some of the most vulnerable in our midst, in particular to the little people in our community. That is a very nice way to be identified as a tribe, I think. I like it. I like that like I like being a Canadian when I travel internationally. That just feels like a lovely identifier. Yeah, well, hipsters of prayer was somebody else's idea, wasn't it? Okay, so you don't know what Trevor's talking about. CBC did this documentary on a bunch of churches, and they tagged them all with something. We got tagged hipsters at prayer. We could have done worse. Right? Losers at prayer comes to mind. Anyway, yeah. Maybe a little less self-interested than the hipsters at prayer. So it's good, right? It feels good. That's nice. I would like to be part of a tribe that cares about its most vulnerable, rather than a tribe that says, well, you know, some of them die and some of them make it, but those are the tough ones, right? You know, to make it binary. Anyhow. Yeah, too bad about your kid. I guess they weren't as strong as mine. Hope to see you next week. Right? You know, like really. Anyway, so it's good. It's all lovely. Now, here's the thing. Okay. Here's the thing, though. I would have to acknowledge in the same breath that I say that feels good to me, and like a good rationale. In the same breath that I would acknowledge that, I would say that it is super vulnerable to the experience of turning into an inward-facing set of priorities. A way of looking out for, all caps in my notes, our kids. That loses its grip on the reason that a tribe that says it wants to figure out how to walk in the way of Jesus exists. Which is to carry every good thing that we have to others and not keep it for ourselves. And we are never more vulnerable to this than when we are occupied with a project that we are deeply personally invested in. When we move toward this thing, this grander thing that seems to be at the heart of the story, which is being a tribe that doesn't face inward but faces outward. Being a tribe that behaves as though whatever good thing we have so that it can be given to every other kind of tribe. That mission is at risk whenever we behave something that has the potential to become self-interested. Does that mean those things that we're engaging in become bad? No. They actually become the milieu in which we can grow and change, in which we can actually challenge the things that are subterranean for us. We can actually start to look at our own behavior consciously and say, you know what? I didn't know that was below the waterline of me, of us. And we need to attend when that happens. We need to be mindful and we need to respond. That's how we grow. So it doesn't suddenly turn the rationale for the the change into a bad rationale or an unsound one. It doesn't suddenly turn what may dominantly feel like good news into bad news. It doesn't suddenly mean we've lost our grip on things that are important as a community. It means that we are vulnerable to, in our engagement with those good things, forgetting what the center of the story is. And the center of the story is we have things that are good so that others can have those things. That's how the story shape goes. It's interesting to me. I mean, Jesus lived a long time ago. And as we have the story spent, the brief years in which he both tried to tell a new shape to this story and live a new shape to this story with a very small group of people, people who were really close to him, who had a chance to sort of see this in action as closely and intimately as anybody in the history of humanity. And there's this really intriguing story where these guys who are walking and talking and everydaying with Jesus, they have this unprecedented opportunity to see what this kind of mission looks like in action. And that group of people who are that close to this thing come to Jesus one day, and they're all bent out of shape because there's this guy that they saw driving out demons in Jesus' name. And when they come to Jesus to tell him the story, they say, and we tried to stop him because he's not one of us. Most of us, I think, would agree that on any given day, less demons in the world is better than more demons in the world, however we think about demons and what those are or aren't. But less would be better than more by almost any definition. And here's a guy who's making the world have less. Arguably doing something good. He's engaging in a difficult hurt. He's healing something that needs to be healed. And yet, when the disciples come to Jesus to describe what they see this person doing, the way they describe it is by identifying him with those others. They say, he's not one of us. And so we tried to shut him down. And to them, it's just as logical as could be. I think it's instructive how Jesus reacts. Because generally, as far as we can tell from what we have of the story, he actually seems pretty chilled about the whole thing. And what he actually says to the disciples is to lay off. Because, quote, whoever is not against you is for you. Is this starting to sound familiar by now? Is the disciples' behavior starting to sound familiar by now? What kind of shape does the disciples' world have? The disciples' world has a shape of us versus them. It has this shape of the good news about God and the good work of God can only be done by tribal insiders, and everything else is somehow not good or not God and should be shut down. And so when Jesus says, whoever is not against you is for you, he just kind of lets the air right out of that balloon. This happens, this story, with Jesus on the scene. Present. Acting this out, we would believe, in a way that we could imitate or engage with as ultimately illustrative of how we should do this. And even in that context, we get this message that it's possible for the good work of God to be going on all around those who claim to be the followers of God, and for those same people to be left out of what God is up to because it doesn't fit with their inward-focused understanding of how God works in the world. And God will work. God will move this story forward, and God will do it with or without the people that claim to be the followers of God. So we get to choose about this again. Damn it. Right? It's always, would somebody please make me a robot so I'll do the right thing? Like, we just have all this agency, all this freedom, right? And this is another one of those. So, here's the question that I want to leave us with today, and that I think should take up a little bit of our brain space the next week and going forward. What does it look like, do you think, to make a change as a community that we understand to be good without having the energy and work that is a necessary part of that change cause us to be inclined to focus inward instead of outward? I'm making that either or for the sake of remembering the question. I know it's not that simple. How do we make a move like this without turning into self-congratulatory navel gazers? To put it in vernacular. That's what I'm going to leave us with. And I'm not leaving us with it because It's a rhetorical question that I will brilliantly answer at some point in the future as a pastor, but because it's actually the kind of question that can only have a communal answer. It can only have the answer that we act out together. So it's ours to answer.